to the Mindspace podcast. I'm Joe Flanders. Thanks for tuning in. It was a tremendous privilege to have a chat with Dr. Patricia Rockman on the podcast today. Pat is a very important teacher of mine and also a physician living in Toronto. She's always had a focus in mental health. She's been a psychotherapist for many years, but now focuses exclusively on teaching mindfulness and training mindfulness teachers. She's run over 100, perhaps close to 150 MBSR and MBCT groups, so she has a huge amount of experience. She, throughout her career, has been involved in training health professionals in a variety of contexts, but now is particularly focused on training mindfulness teachers. And she's really the lead on the MBSR and MBCT teacher certifications that are offered through the Center for Mindfulness Studies and that Mindspace hosts in Montreal. And so we got a chance to talk about those programs and including the events that are coming up this spring in Montreal. Pat will be coming to do an MBCT training that is not to be missed. All the information about that programming is available at the Center for Mindfulness Studies website. That's mindfulnessstudies.com. And of course, on the Mindspace website, mindspacewellbeing.com. And I'm also pushing updates regularly at Dr. Joe Flanders on Facebook and Twitter. Now, as for the specifics of the conversation today, it was interesting. It felt like it took a while for it to get up to speed, like Pat needed to warm up or something. But after the first couple of questions, she really got rolling and gave us some fairly candid statements about some touchy areas in the mindfulness community, including some of the politics among the different institutions, the controversies surrounding attempts to regulate teacher development. She talked in a very interesting way about what makes a good mindfulness teacher, and of course, her passion for the practice of inquiry in mindfulness-based interventions. It turned out to be quite a stimulating and thought-provoking conversation, and I'm glad to present it to you here. Hi, Pat. Welcome to the Mindspace podcast.
Hi, Joe. I'm glad to be here.
All right. So I'll just briefly introduce you to our listeners. Pat is an associate professor at the University of Toronto. She's a physician with a focus practice in mental health, particularly in mindfulness. And she's also the Director of Education and Clinical Services at the Center for Mindfulness Studies. Lots of information about that center and Pat is available at mindfulnessstudies.com. So Pat, maybe you can just start by telling us your background and how you ended up getting involved in mindfulness.
Well, I was a family physician in general practice for a while, but I was always interested in psychotherapy and psychology. And I eventually transitioned into doing that after having a bunch of training in cognitive behavior therapy and other modalities. And from the time I was quite young, I was involved in my own therapy and, for a lack of better language, a journey of self-discovery and growth. And this led me to a number of areas. One, as I said, my own personal psychotherapy. And then I studied Sufism for quite a while and the work of Gurdjieff, who was an esoteric mystic in the late 40s and 50s in Europe. And then after I was in medical practice for quite some time and doing psychotherapy, I had studied with Zindel Siegel, and I'm not really sure how I heard about the training that he was doing in mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, but I went to Omega in 2005 and studied with him and with Susan Woods in the MBCT program, and then came back to Toronto and started running groups. After that, I hooked up with him and talked him into mentoring a group of us. And in addition, I studied Buddhist psychology with Michael Stone for a year and other teachers, Molly Swan and Norman Feldman. And in 2011, we opened the Center for Mindfulness Studies, and I started to run a 1 and 2 day workshops in mindfulness-based programs, and began teaching with Zindel, the 5 day mindfulness-based cognitive therapy intensive, I think in 2012, I believe.
Okay, I noticed that you didn't mention your training in clowning, which for obvious reasons doesn't make it into the professional CV there, but you've got a lot of diverse training experiences. I'm just curious if you would tell us how your training in clowning actually fits with your mindfulness practice.
Well, in 2005, I had a bout of thyroid cancer, and I decided at that point to take a yoga teacher training program. And also, I'd wanted to study clown for many years. I'm not really sure why. And I was particularly interested in the work of Mump and Smoot, who are two clowns that produce work that is quite dark. And so I took an introductory program with them, with Mump in particular. His actual name is Mike Kennard. And then proceeded to take a number of courses. And I would say that that form of clown, which originates with a man named Richard Pachinko, who died a number of years ago, is a blend of First Nations work and chakra study and theater and clown. It's a bit crazy, actually. But it's also quite structured. And I would say it fits with mindfulness in that there was a way in which when one is clowning, particularly this form of clowning, which is not therapeutic clown, it's not kids clown, demands of the clown that they be authentic and have a present moment orientation at all times. So they do their best not to ignore whatever is happening in the room and to be honest and to track their experience and to really, I have to say again, to be very present. And while the development of a clown piece is quite structured, at the same time, there's a lot of uncertainty inherent in the practice of clown, which is the same with mindfulness. And one also has to be willing to go with whatever is showing up in the room, also the same as what is required of us when we're engaged in mindfulness practice, both as practitioners and teachers.
Cool. Thank you for that. You mentioned doing some teacher training with Zindel Siegel, and I definitely want to talk about all the work you're doing in that area. Maybe first tell us about the Center for Mindfulness Studies, like what the organization does and your role.
Well, Tita Angenko and myself co-founded the Center for Mindfulness Studies in 2011, and we came together because I had an interest in clinical service delivery and mindfulness, and also in professional training. And she had an interest in social justice and in meeting the needs of the disadvantaged or those who have affordability and access issues. And we set up our place in a social housing building in downtown Toronto and proceeded to offer MBCT groups, and she started to apply for grants and funding to be able to deliver the work to people in need. And so out of that has grown. We now offer, I think, close to 100 groups a year, and as well as we have an MBCT certification program, of which Zindel Siegel and Susan Woods are a part. And we also are now offering an MBSR certification program. And more recently, we're starting to bring mindful self-compassion training to Toronto. And as you well know, we are collaborating with you at Mindspace and bringing the training in MBCT to Montreal.
And MBSR. And all of us Montrealers feel incredibly privileged to have that opportunity. And I'll just fill in where, you know, you're especially humble. I'll just fill in the very important point that the Center for Mindfulness Studies has become the Canadian reference for mindfulness delivery and training. So what you guys have put together in a short period of time is really quite impressive, and we're lucky to have you doing what you're doing.
Thanks. That's very kind of you.
So let's talk about MBCT and MBSR.
Okay.
I think probably most people will be familiar with those programs, but they're quite similar in some ways and a little different. How would you describe the role of these two programs in a center delivering programming to the general public?
This is a good question, because there definitely is overlap and there are also differences. I would say that both their differences and similarities arise out of their origins. So MBSR, as most people know, is originally developed by Jon Kabat-Zinn. And I don't know if it's true, but the apocryphal story is that he was on a meditation retreat and the 8-week program came to him out of his head, just kind of like Zeus's daughter, Athena. Wasn't she born out of his head? Anyway, I don't know if that's true, but it definitely is derived from Vipassana meditation or insight meditation, the MBSR program. And it was originally developed to treat people with chronic disease predominantly, you know, for whom you could say medicine had really given up on. Now, what's interesting is that neither Jon Kabat-Zinn nor Saki Santarelli are clinicians. So Saki Santarelli is an educator and Jon Kabat-Zinn, microbiologist, I believe. And yet what they were doing was located within a clinical setting. So this is interesting. And then they developed OASIS and they're located within UMass and, you know, have been running programs and training programs for quite some time. I would say that MBSR is quite broad in its reach and that it is not necessarily sold, if you like, as a clinical intervention, although it is for stress reduction. It has taken a long time for the protocol, and I'll say that in quotations, because Jon Kabat-Zinn was quite loath to write it down in any more manualized fashion for the longest time than what was in Full Catastrophe Living. So this resulted in a number of people being trained from a variety of disciplines, giving it both great breadth, but also potentially leading to some confusion. I think the view that they held for the longest time, I don't know if they still do, was that if you had a deep enough practice, a good teacher this would make. Then MBCT comes along in the form of Zindel Siegel, John Teasdale, and Mark Williams in the early 2000s or late 90s. And they put together cognitive behavior therapy and mindfulness. They did a lot of work with Jon Kabat-Zinn. They went down to UMass when they put together their program. But their protocol was very structured, very developed. And if people have studied MBCT, they know the work of Siegel and his cohorts affectionately as the Green Book. That's not its title. It's really mindfulness-based cognitive therapy for preventing relapse. And there's now a second edition. But this protocol is really highly manualized, and that text, somebody could read it and they could deliver a program. I'm not saying it would necessarily be the best program, but they could do it. But it was developed really for preventing depressive relapse, and where the evidence was the strongest was in treating those people who had had 3 or more episodes of depression. Zindel is a clinical psychologist and a clinician scientist. And thus that particular modality entered healthcare in a big way, and a lot of research has sprung, you know, from it, making it in some ways, well, particularly I would say in healthcare, probably more known, or many other adaptations have come out of it because of the research that I think has gone into it. Having said that, we all know the research is still quite early and young. So the main differences are, I would say, MBCT is really directed toward a mental health population for preventing depressive relapse, although in reality, in the community, many more people with many other mental health problems are taking it, particularly those with anxiety, bipolarity, and addictions, you name it. MBSR was predominantly directed at those with chronic illness and stress. So it really, I think, teaches a practice in a much broader way, whereas MBCT is teaching a wedge of the practice, much more oriented toward dealing with difficulty and difficult mind and mood states.
So you, of course, have taken on the challenge of training people to deliver these programs. And I'd love to hear how the certification that you offer was developed, both the MBCT one and the MBSR one, how it came to pass that you train people and CMS offers the certification, and then, you know, how that has been received in the broader community.
Well, once I was doing MBCT for a couple of years, I've always trained healthcare providers from the time I first went into medicine and before. I was a registered massage therapist for many years when it wasn't hip, and I was training massage therapists and other people to learn how to do massage and various complementary medicine modalities. So I've been involved in various aspects of stress reduction and training healthcare providers for many, many years. I would say that it was a natural outgrowth of my interest in that this would come into my mindfulness-based work. I've done a lot of work for the Ontario College of Family Physicians in continuing education and professional development. When I started the center with Tita, we decided to develop a one-day introduction to mindfulness and a two-day introduction to MBCT, MBCT basics, because a lot of people didn't know about the work, and what was available was Zindel's 5-day intensive in MBCT, and that was about it. And when I took the 5-day MBCT, I felt ready to go and deliver groups, but many people who come out of it don't and didn't then. The 2-day and the 1-day were introductory, and this helped, I guess, feed people's interest to come and take a 5-day. Then when I started teaching the 5-day with Zindel, people wanted more because they didn't feel ready to teach. So I developed a practicum, which is 10 weeks and 3.5 hours a night, in which the participants go through the MBCT program session by session and get feedback on their teaching. It's quite structured. And what became evident from that was that people were really struggling with inquiry, and I studied inquiry with Susan Woods, and then I studied inquiry again with Susan Woods when I brought her to Toronto and developed a 2-day program in inquiry again because there was a need in the community. People were really struggling with this aspect of the MBCT program.
Maybe you can just talk about what inquiry is, like for somebody that wouldn't be familiar with the term.
Inquiry is a process of what we're now calling a contemplative dialogue, a conversation, a reflection, questions that come immediately following a meditative practice, in which we are inquiring into the mindfulness practice or the cognitive exercise that a participant has engaged in order to help them to notice, recognize their experience for what it is, learn how to track it and to describe it. And then also begin to consider how they would integrate what they're learning into their daily lives to reduce their suffering. And the primary attitudes that we want the teacher to bring to this process with his or her participants is our curiosity and compassion. So I don't know if that answers the question.
Absolutely. And believe me, I'm going to ask you a lot more about inquiry in a sec, but maybe you can tell us the origins of the MBSR certification, because I know it's quite different.
So the MBSR certification here came from my relationship with Susan Woods. After I brought her to teach her advanced teacher training intensive at Inquiry to Ontario, I invited her to teach the two-day Inquiry workshop I developed, and she came, and then she asked me if I wanted to teach with her on an ongoing basis. And we got to talking about MBSR, and I asked her if she thought it would make sense to bring MBSR, that certification, to Ontario, because she had developed an MBCT and MBSR certification at the University of California, San Diego, in their Mindfulness Professional Training Institute. And she thought it would be, and so I did. So we use her protocol and teaching packet, and she and I are now teaching the MBSR 6-day foundational training here in Toronto, and we offer an introductory core concepts one day at the center, and then our certification doesn't have a practicum, but it includes more mentoring hours than we have in the MBCT program. We also added mentorship to the MBCT program based on what she was doing in her certification, because really, as it turns out, people do need mentoring and supervision. And then people also come and take the Inquiry programs and the MBSR certification as well.
So teacher certification is a very controversial area. And, people might not know who Susan Woods is. And so it might be interesting for us to hear her background. But, you know, how is it that, you know, the Center for Mindful Studies, or Susan Woods for that matter, gets to decide that someone can have a certificate in MBCT based on your or her training curriculum? And then even more controversially around MBSR, where it's pretty tightly controlled by CFM, if I understand correctly.
Well, you'd think it was pretty tightly controlled, except we're doing it, aren't we?
So how does that happen?
Well, Susan got agreement from John to develop the curriculum at UCSD. She's a senior trainer. She was trained at UMass with John Kabat-Zinn and other senior teachers there many years ago. She's been around for quite a long time. And John allows people to use the name MBSR if they're meeting certain requirements, one of which is having a day-long retreat and a bunch of other things. And I mean, your question's a really good one, right? Because the field's not regulated. Mm-hmm. So it's a great question. It's not regulated. And some people would like it to be regulated, but I don't think it'll ever be regulated, because you have to prove that you can do harm. And within the context of MBCT, all of the people that we train have a clinical or a professional designation. So they're covered by a governing body who is regulating them. Mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, or MBSR, within that context is then seen as a modality that they are using that falls within their scope of practice. MBSR is a slightly different story because, as I said earlier on, there are all kinds of people who train to deliver it. You could be in business, you could be a lawyer, you could be any number of things, an HR consultant. What is asked of these people usually is that they have an advanced degree or equivalent. I have mixed feelings about that. And you could say, well, who am I to have mixed feelings about that? But since we have brought MBSR into the Center for Mindfulness Studies, and this may be because we started out with MBCT, which is really specifically developed and directed at a clinical population, what we have found is that a lot of the people who come to our MBSR groups have a lot of pathology. They have a lot of mental health and other problems that wouldn't be picked up if you didn't do a fairly in-depth intake or assessment. And I don't know really what's going on in a field that's unregulated and where people are often practicing in isolation, particularly in the US, where it's a very, very big country and people are scattered all over the place. And in teaching the advanced teacher training intensive with Susan, you really see a great variety in the quality of what's being delivered. So what makes us the arbiters of who should be certified, and how do we know that they're even good enough to practice? Well, really, on one level, you could argue we're self-appointed. On another, you could argue that we have the trust of the community because they hire us to do this on an ongoing basis, inside and outside of the academy. And we have a lot of experience in the field. I've run over 140 groups and have extensive experience in adult education. So on that level, I think that makes me qualified. But what you're also addressing implicitly is the issue of competency in teacher training. And this is much more difficult to address because Rebecca Crane has developed the teacher assessment criteria, which has some validity, but again, it's still very, very early days. And there are some studies that would say that having longer training doesn't necessarily make you a better teacher. And there are some people who would say that if you don't have a meditation practice, you're going to get less good results. But again, this research is very, very, very early. So we don't really know. We don't know. But what I would say is that we're in a field that has taken Western culture by storm. And meditation, A, it's not a panacea, and B, it's not risk-free. And I think that to the best of our ability as clinicians and professionals in the various fields we are in, we have a duty to serve our clients or patients and to not do harm. And by developing a protocol that we evaluate and test with our participants and our trainees at this particular point in time, without additional research, I think we're doing really the best we can. Yeah. And I mean, supervision, as you know, is a long time-tested way to deal with competency for clinicians. Is it flawed? Absolutely. Do we have something better? I'm not sure what it is.
Mm-hmm. So what's interesting here is that certainly MBSR was, you know, like started by Jon Kabat-Zinn, and its mothership is the Center for Mindfulness at UMass.
Yeah.
But the same, you know, that's not necessarily the case for MBCT. You might think MBCT has its origins in Toronto or maybe the UK, but they also teach MBCT at the Center for Mindfulness. How has that worked out in terms of MBCT being a different program, but also very similar to CFM? How have they responded to the emergence of MBCT and the need for teacher training?
Well, they're not doing teacher training in MBCT at this point.
Why not?
You want an honest answer?
Just between us.
I think it's predominantly political. I think where there are people, there will be issues related to power. And I think, as you said, the CFM has had quite a tight hold on MBSR, but the horse is out of the barn because there are people teaching MBSR now all over the world. And the practice was around long before MBSR or MBCT. This makes it complicated. They haven't responded to us teaching MBSR, MBCT at all. And we have Zindel Siegel here in Toronto, and Zindel's an advisor to us, and he's very connected with the center, and he supports what we're doing. So that's another reason, I guess, we are able to run a certification program because we have his blessing as one of the developers. And then we have relationships with people like Norm Farb, a neuroscientist in the field, and others. They haven't really responded. This is what I mean. It's not regulated. Mm-hmm. It's kind of the Wild West, actually. But people want to be trained well if they're interested in this work, because I think for them, it meets a number of needs. And one of those is a need for meaning and for personal transcendence. That's my view. And I think it's really congruent in a culture that is privileging science, but is also finding itself with declining interest in religion and other things that provide meaning to human beings. And this fits the bill. It's scientificized. We're not talking about God for those who don't want to talk about God. And yet we're helping people to get both personal and professional meaning. It combines both together. So it's quite attractive. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that certainly would explain to some extent the interest in both learning mindfulness and people wanting to teach. I wonder how you feel about the development of a regulating body for teachers. And in particular, I know there's a new regulating body that just sort of announced itself, speaking about self-appointment, the Mindfulness Teachers Association, International Mindfulness Teachers Association. So maybe your take on having a regulating body in general and your thoughts on that one in particular.
Okay, well, first of all, I don't think it's going to happen. Because a regulating body that actually has any teeth has to be related to the government in some way, right? If it's going to be a college or something. And in MBCT particularly, as I was saying earlier, we're already regulated. You're regulated as a psychologist. I'm regulated as a physician. We don't need to be regulated by another body. And what government is going to take on regulating mindfulness? I mean, maybe it'll happen sometime, but I kind of doubt it. But the interest in regulation, I think, is actually a sign of a desire for professionalization and a desire, although people would kill me for saying this, an interest in increased status and credibility and power, because that regulation gives you that as well. But really, from a government perspective, they're only going to regulate something that they think can cause harm. But if you look at other modalities like cognitive behavior therapy, it's not regulated by the government. It's because it's regulated under your scope of practice. Mm-hmm. So I don't see why mindfulness would be any different than that.
So then the International Mindfulness Teachers Association is not that useful, not that relevant, could turn into a government-based regulating body?
Okay, I don't know enough about them except that I'm not sure what they have done following their initial announcement, because there was a big backlash and hoo-ha when they came out with their announcement. Because if you go and look at the website, they consist predominantly of Dharma teachers. And they made a mistake in that they didn't consult the whole community. Because actually, even though North America is very big, the mindfulness community is very small. And a number of people took offense that these people who, yes, they're very well-known Dharma teachers, and some of them were working in the field of mindfulness-based programs, but most of them were not. And the reaction really was, who are you? What is your mission? What makes you think you can just say you are going to be doing this and everybody will follow suit? They really had to deal with a lot of reaction to what they're doing. So I don't know what's going to happen with it. But really, if you want to do something like this, you have to be incredibly inclusive, because it's going to be very political. and territorial. Mm-hmm. So really, what do I think? Not much. I don't care about them. Okay. I don't. That's, this is bad because people are going to listen to this. But anyway,
I hope so.
Well, maybe they won't now. But I mean, I have great respect for many of the people associated with the IMTA, but I think they made, I really think they made a big mistake in how they came about doing this. And I'm not sure they were supposed to be directed at those of us who are working in clinically based mindfulness programs, but that really wasn't clear. Mm-hmm. And there are many people who are involved in mindfulness-based programs who have a lot of experience in developing educational programs and criteria and certification programs, like Susan Woods, like some of us here. Anyway, it just, I just think, really what I think is, I think they made a mistake. And I'm not sure we need them. I have enough police. I have the College of Physicians and Surgeons on top of me. I don't need the IMTA on top of me.
All right, so let's get back to your own experience, your own training, your own capacities as a trainer.
Yeah.
What makes a good mindfulness teacher?
Oh, this is the million-dollar question. I have a lot of opinions about this.
That's really surprising, Pat.
But they really are just that. Although I have trained many people and we have a select group of faculty at the center. And to be perfectly honest, the people who come to work at the center, I am the one who essentially decides who is faculty and who is not. I'm sure this won't last for much longer. And we'll come up with some other more bureaucratic way of doing this. But what I believe makes a good mindfulness teacher are a number of things. Of course, what makes a good MBSR teacher and what makes a good MBCT teacher may not be the same. And most of my experiences in MBCT, I have some, but it's much more recent in training MBSR teachers. They are, I think, a different kettle of fish. Sometimes they are actually more flexible and adaptable because they often don't come with the same baggage that we as clinicians come with from our prior training. On the other hand, they may be missing some really important pieces that we have. But if we talk in general terms, I think that what makes a good MBCT teacher is somebody who really is committed and motivated. They really want to learn the work. They're extremely curious and open. They're willing to take feedback. They're willing to not know. They're willing to sit in uncertainty. This is a very difficult place for a lot of adults and professionals to sit. Whereas what we're asking of a mindfulness teacher is that they are able to be present for whatever is arising in the group, and that they can both guide the group but allow themselves to be led by their participants. This is a dance. Also, the mindfulness teacher within the context of mindfulness-based programs has to hold a lot of variables in mind when they're teaching. There's the protocol, there are the themes and key teaching points, there are the practices, the cognitive exercises, there's holding the group, there's the learning of the individual participant, there are group dynamics, there's time management and logistics, it goes on and on, right? And then there's, you know, there's the guidance of the practice, there's being in the practice, and then there's delivering inquiry. So it requires somebody who can hold a lot and who can also bring their practice into the room so that they can be in the practice when they are both guiding and facilitating inquiry. Those are some of the elements.
Very nice. Thank you for that.
Mm-hmm. One other thing.
Yep.
One other thing. I think to be a good mindfulness teacher, it requires a good critical and analytical mind, although this can also get in your way in the beginning. Because I always say when I'm training people, it's important that you know why you're doing what you're doing, that you have a rationale for it. We're not trying to train mindful idiots. I'm not looking for people to just simply, you know, drink the Kool-Aid or to be converted. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I know that inquiry is a big part of the teacher training at CMS. I'd be curious to know why you think inquiry is so important in MBIs, and also how you train it. It seems really tricky to develop the skill. So how do you approach training other people in inquiry?
Well, I'm very immersed in this right now because Susan Woods, Evan Collins, who is a colleague and senior teacher at CMS, and myself, we're writing a book for New Harbinger that'll come out next year. And it's really around teaching as practice, and practice as teaching, and embodied mindful presence and inquiry is central to this. And how we teach it is very much a part of this book. So to that end, I've been thinking about this a lot. Why I think it's so important is a good question. I would say that a less formed kind of inquiry has always been present in meditative practice, although it would usually show up between an individual and a teacher in traditional meditation. It doesn't usually take place in a group format. And in MBSR, a form of inquiry in terms of reflecting on practice was present, but its aspects and characteristics were not explicated. It was within MBCT that this first began to be expressed in a clearer, more structured form. I would say Rebecca Crane was the person who probably really did the most work on that initially. And why I think it's important is because if we think about what we believe we are doing in mindfulness-based programs, particularly from the lens that we are working, we are working to help people come to fully know their experience. And this involves learning to, as I said earlier, notice it, recognize it, describe it, and then be able to glean insight and learning from that and implement what is learned into their daily lives to deal with difficult mind and mood states or stress and function in healthier, more skillful ways. Inquiry, we believe, helps to facilitate that process because in the dialogue, in the back and forth reflecting on a participant's experience, we are helping them to begin to identify and parse the components of experience, their thoughts, emotions, body sensations, behaviors or impulses to act, to be able to see that these can be separated out. They can be deconstructed and they can be described. This then leads us to a present moment orientation, or within the context of neuroscience, we would refer to this as experiential self-referencing versus narrative self-referencing, which is what we usually do. We are problem-solving creatures. We have a strong view of self that we reinforce over and over again through incidents and the stories that we tell ourselves about our experience, the explanations, the interpretations, the conclusions, the ideas we have, and this becomes our fixed reality. But these things may not actually be true. They may be simply be ideas. So for example, the profoundly depressed person or the anxious person or the really stressed person may see themselves as somehow hopeless or not competent. And they tell themselves this over and over. They have an ongoing narrative about this. Unable or unwilling to recognize their strengths or other possibilities or times when they are not depressed or anxious or stressed. And one of the aims of mindfulness is to start to help people to both engage with the entirety of their experience, the joys and the difficulties, and to be able to approach and expose themselves to the unwanted to find healthier ways of dealing with it. So inquiry, first of all, helps us to do this describing and this parsing of experience to make it more manageable, to begin to look at the attitudes that we bring to our experience, often harsh judgments and self-evaluations, and begin to cultivate other attitudes of curiosity and compassion. This is embodied in the teacher. This is elicited from the participants and also reflected back to them through comments, reframing, discussions about the key themes. But inquiry is also primarily using tenets of adult education and transformative learning. We engage in an experience, a meditation or a cognitive exercise. We reflect upon it. This is what adults do. This is what they need. Then they abstractly conceptualize it. Then they test out the learning. This is what we do when we ask people to both be in practice in the session and apply it to their daily lives. MBIs then really use adult education in a very, very deep way, and inquiry is essential to that. This is how we bring change.
So a lot of subtle skills to develop there. How do you train people to be good at it?
Well, we don't really know. But so then you could say, well, why do people come and pay you good money when you don't know? Maybe that's why, because we don't know. We're learning as we go. What we do is we begin with a foundation and a structure. I'm not sure this is the right way because it has problems. We begin with a foundation and a structure, asking particular questions. We call them layers that do these things I was talking about earlier. So we teach them those layers. We teach them how to ask questions in this particular way. We ask them how to, we teach them how to reflect on experience with their participants and their own experience in this particular way. We then supervise and mentor them when they are leading groups, and we give them feedback on how they're asking questions, what they're saying, what they're doing, how they're getting in their own way. We are trying to teach them to get out of their own way and to begin to really actively listen without inserting themselves to the experience of their participants. And this takes a lot of time. And this is why I said a good teacher has to be really open, because they have to look at themselves. I mean, you know this. Mm-hmm. You know, you and I have talked about this a lot, and how easy it is for us to be performative. And all of a sudden we're inserting something into the process that we actually have to unlearn. We have to take out or know when to use it judiciously. So it requires a lot of learning on the part of the trainer. So once they have this foundation and structure, then we begin to really try to help them to make inquiry a practice. How can they teach, guide, inquire from a place of personal practice? So it is no longer a cognitive exercise, but rather they are in the practice when they are engaging in inquiry and running their groups.
And having gone through a lot of training with you and Susan, what I find particularly challenging is, as one is learning inquiry and maybe the curriculum in general, is, again, because it's experiential, you don't know what you don't know. And so, you know, the learning sort of like unfolds or reveals itself as you go into it. And so I have a lot of respect for the challenge of having to shape the learning experience for the, you know, trainee. So a lot of respect to you guys for taking on that challenge. I wonder, maybe a final question, because I'm mindful of your time here. I wonder how all of this focus on training others, particularly in inquiry, has shaped your own practice, your own mindfulness practice, and your teaching practice.
I think teaching deepens our own practice and inquiry. I think I feel very grateful and blessed to be working with the people that I work with, both my own mentors and the people that I train. I am continually learning from them in terms of guidance, how to show up, how to be vulnerable, how to shape my own guidance and inquiry. And I believe that the repeated exposure to this kind of practice has enabled me, when I'm in the process of running a group, inquiring, dealing with trainees and participants, to be present and in practice most of the time. And I think this is because I no longer have to carry a lot of that cognitive load around the form, you know, the structure of the protocol, but rather can really be with those people that I'm training and able to really listen for the key themes and points as they arise through our interactions and when they're teaching.
Okay. Thank you for that. Anything else you want to say about the center, the certification program, how people should think about getting training in this area?
I think you said something really important a few minutes ago, which is both a great strength and also a challenge, which is that we don't know what we don't know. And people who are taking our certification programs are committing a lot of time and money and energy. And there is clearly something in it for them. And there is clearly something in this practice as it has it at its root, you know, 2,600 years of tradition. But I think that when one wants to engage in this work as a teacher, I think it's important to ask oneself why one wants to do that, what it's in the service of, as Susan Woods would say, and to always keep your questioning, you know, your skepticism on your shoulder, even as you leap in without looking and having to swim around this uncertain sea. And to understand that there's so much we really don't know. We don't know, and it's evolving, and it's dynamic, and it's organic. And if one wants to sign on for that, welcome.
Well, we can welcome everybody in a very concrete way as well, by talking about some of the opportunities coming up this spring in Montreal. And all that information is going to be available on the Mindspace website. That's mindspacewellbeing.com, as well as on the Center for Mindfulness Studies website, which is mindfulnessstudies.com. In both cases, it's the professional development tab. And so programming both on the MBSR certification pathway and the MBCT certification pathway. And very exciting to say that, Pat, you'll actually be coming to Montreal. Do you want to just tell us what you're going to be doing this spring in Montreal?
I'm coming in May to kick off your first practicum intensive, and I'll be leading half of it. And then my dear colleague and senior trainer, Evan Collins, will be coming to do the second part. And this will be over two and a half day periods where we will run through the practicum. So we'll run the participants, the students, through the entire program, in which they will be both participant observers and facilitators. So they will wear many hats. It's a very fun program. I really enjoy teaching it because it has a lot of intellectually interesting pieces to it, as well as a lot of practice.
Well, I, for one, am really looking forward to seeing you and being there. I wonder if there's anything we might say about where to look for this book that you were talking about, because it sounds like it's going to be very interesting and stimulating. What's the time frame on the publication here?
Well, we just got an extension on the end of it. We will have it. We will have it into the publisher by the middle of May. And I'm not sure. I think it'll come out in the spring of 2019 by New Harbinger.
Okay. And maybe will there be news about it on the Mindfulness Studies website or social media feeds, or do people need to rely on me for that?
Oh yeah. No, we'll make sure that we make it public.
Okay. Super. So thanks so much, Pat. It was a pleasure talking with you, and looking forward to having you in Montreal.
Thanks a lot, Joe. It was lovely to talk to you.
All right. Take care.
Okay. Bye.